Chapter 2. If you were to stand at the window in Hewlands and crane your neck sideways, it would be possible to see the edge of the forest. You might find it a restless, verdant, inconstant sight. The wind caresses, ruffles, disturbs the mass of leaves. Each tree answers to the weather's ministrations at a slightly different tempo from its neighbour, bending and shuddering and tossing its branches as if trying to get away from the air, from the very soil that nourishes it. On a morning in early spring, 15 years or so before Hamlet runs to the house of the physician, a Latin tutor is standing in this place at the window, absently tugging on the hoop through his left ear. He is watching the trees, their collective presence, lined up as they are, fringing the edge of the farm, brings to his mind the backdrop of a theatre, the kind of painted trickery that is unrolled quickly into place to let the audience know they are now in a sylvan setting, that the city or streets of the previous scene are gone, that they are now on wooded, uncultivated, perhaps unstable ground. A slight frown appears on his face. He remains at the window, the fingertips of one hand pressed white to the glass. The boys are behind him. They are conjugating verbs, temporarily unheard by the tutor, who is intent on the startling contrast between the sharply blue spring sky and the new leaf green of the forest. The colours seem to fight, vying for supremacy, vibrancy, the green versus the blue, one against the other. The children's Latin verbs wash over him, through him, like the wind through the trees. Somewhere in the farmhouse a bell is rung, first briefly and then more insistently. There are footfalls along the passage, the sound of a door banging into its frame. One of the boys, the younger one, James, the tutor knows without turning, sighs, coughs, clears his throat, then rejoins the intoning. The tutor readjusts his collar, smooths his hair. The Latin verbs roll on and on around him like a Fenland fog, through his feet, up and over his shoulders, past his ears, to seep out of the cracks in the window lead. He allows the chanted words to merge into an aural blur that fills the room, right to its high blackened rafters. It collects up there, along with the curls and veils of smoke from the chimneyless fire that smoulders in the grate. He has instructed the boys to conjugate the verb incarcerare. The repeated hard C sound seems to scrape at the walls of the room, as if the very words themselves are seeking escape. The tutor is forced to come here twice a week by his father, the glover, who is in some manner of debt to Hewlands, after the souring of an agreement or deal with the yeoman who used to own the farm. The yeoman had been a broad-backed man who carried through his belt a sheep-hook shaped like a cudgel, and there was something about his open, candid face that the tutor had rather liked. But the yeoman had died suddenly last year, leaving all his acres and flocks along with a wife and 8 or 9 children. The tutor is unsure exactly how many. It was an event his own father had greeted with barely concealed glee. Only he knew of the nature of the loan, the tutor had overheard his father crowing late at night when he thought no one could overhear. The tutor is very good at clandestine listening. Don't you see? The widow will not know, or if she does, will not dare to come and ask me to make good on it, or that overgrown dullard of an eldest son. It appears, however, that the widow or son has done just that, and this arrangement, the tutor has gleaned from listening into conversations going on behind the door of his parents' chamber, is something to do with what his father did with the consignment of the yeoman's sheepskins. His father had told the yeoman that the hides were to be sent for whittling, and the yeoman had believed him. But then his father had insisted that the wool should be left on, which had aroused the suspicion of the yeoman, which for some reason has caused all this trouble. The tutor is unclear on this last point, as his mother was called away from the whispered conversation by the querulous creaking cry of Edmund, her youngest child. The tutor's glover father has some new, slightly illicit venture that none of them are supposed to know about. This much the tutor can tell. They were to make out, their parents told them, to anyone who asked, that the sheepskins were for gloves. He and his siblings had been baffled, as it had not occurred to them that the skins were for anything other than gloves. Whatever else could his father, the most successful glover in town, possibly want them for? There is a debt or a fine, and their father cannot, will not pay, and the yeoman's widow or son will not let it drop, so it appears that he himself is the payment. His time, his Latin grammar, his brain. Twice a week, his father told him, he must walk them...